Now, a leading housing expert says figures suggest that Ireland has built more properties for rent than for sale for the first time in generations. The figures also show that despite the number of newly built properties more than doubling from 2017 to 2022, the proportion of properties landing on the market for sale throughout this period has dropped by 43.5%. Well, Dr. Lorcan Sir is Senior Lecturer in Housing at the Technological University of Dublin. Good morning, Lorcan, and thanks for joining us.
Morning, Owen.
So just expand on those figures and what you mean, because essentially you're saying we're not building the type of housing that we need in this country.
Yeah, exactly. So what has happened over the years is that housing output since 2017 has gone up by over 100%, 109%, something like that. And of course, when you hear politicians talk, they'll tell you that, you know, we're building 29,500 houses last year, whatever it was, 29,851. But of course, not all of those houses come to the market. And what I mean by come to the market means, like, will turn up in your local estate agent's window as a new house ready for you to go in and buy. And back 20 years ago, about two-thirds of all houses that we built every year came to the market, so ended up in your estate agent's window. Now, you're never going to get all the houses that we build every year coming to the market, because there'll be a lot of people, particularly in Kildare and beyond, who will build their own house for themselves, and that'll never be sold as a new house. And also a lot of councils build social housing and they never come on the market, obviously. That figure in 2017 was about half, so about 51%, half of all the new houses that we built in 2017 came to the market. Last year, that was just over 28%. So what you see is the amount of new houses that we're building that are becoming available for people to buy, whether they're first-time buyers or movers, or even landlords, it has declined as output has gone up. And that's a bit of a problem. And what's replacing it really is that we've seen a huge increase in the amount of social housing that's being built, which is fine. It's gone up from about 12% to about 25%. We've seen a decline in one-off housing, but we've also seen a huge upsurge in the amount of apartments that are being built for rent, over 420%, something like that. So we see apartments, last year, for example, we've seen over 9,100 brand new apartments being built, and they would be for rent either for social housing or for institutional funds, and only just over 8,000 houses came on the market for sale. So that's what I'm saying there, that we built more housing units that are available for rent, either social or private, than we built houses that are available for sale.
Okay, earlier this morning we had a debate with Ono Brin, Sinn Féin spokesperson on housing, and James Lawless, Fianna Fáil TD for Kildare North, regarding the eviction ban. If we just bring you in on that discussion, Lorcan, what's your view on whether or not that eviction ban should have stayed in place, and particularly in the context that we are building, as you say, more apartments for rent now, but we don't seem to be helping renters?
Well, a lot of the people who are renting, don't forget, their rent is more expensive than a mortgage. So if we were building more houses for sale, those people would be able to move out and, you know, get a mortgage and find a house that they could live in. I think if you're going to end an eviction ban, you need to have some kind of protection in place. You can't just let these people fall off a cliff and become homeless. And remember, an eviction ban in Ireland is an unusual thing. It's the norm everywhere else, you know. There's very few countries where tenants have such limited security of tenure. I think what I would have done, Owen, if I was the minister, is that I would have increased tenant security of tenure. So the reasons whereby landlords can repossess the properties, they need to be tightened up, to be honest with you. The fact that you can have your parents-in-law, a landlord can reclaim a property because their father-in-law wants to live in it, or their nephew coming up from Kerry to go to Maynooth University to do a degree, that's not a good enough reason. In other countries, that's only the spouse of the landlord can that's the only reason to do it. But at the same time, I think landlords are overtaxed. I mean, they're paying 51-52% tax on the rental income. And in other jurisdictions around the world, that's treated as business income, so it's taxed as corporate income. And it's also inequitable that you see large funds paying almost zero tax on the rental income, where your local, your local landlord in Clane or in Fallons there is paying, 51-52% of rental income. That's inequitable as well. So I think the eviction ban probably needed to stay until there was an alternative in place. But I mean, one of the ways, quick wins there, is to sort out the tax situation for landlords to make any eviction ban much more palatable to them.
So there's no real incentive then for people to move out of their rental property into their newly built a property if they were to buy it, because the market is so small. Do you think that we are moving then to that kind of model where we're pushing rent and rent is kind of becoming more attractive, or so it would try to seem more attractive?
It's definitely not becoming more attractive. But it's definitely becoming, the other options are becoming limited. We see in Dublin City, for example, we see the amount of new homes coming on the market over the last 5 years down by nearly 75%. In Kildare, it's up nearly 300%, because when you squeeze the balloon in somewhere like Dublin, it gets inflated elsewhere, which is typically places like Kildare, Meath, and things like that. Other countries have a much higher proportion of their population renting, which is fine, but they also have real security of tenure. In other words, they can stay there all their lives, their rents are affordable, and they don't rely on their property for wealth. So you got to remember, Owen, I suppose, that each person listening to this program this morning is worth on average of €200,000. Now, most people are going to go, what? And they won't find it when they look in their Bank of Ireland app. But most of our wealth, 2/3 of that wealth is in our property. So you might not have it in your bank account. But when you go home to your house that you pay €200,000 for, it's now worth €400,000. That's where your wealth is. So other countries don't have that asset-based welfare system, we call it. Whereas for us, our property is our wealth. So the idea of channeling people into long-term renting, you know, it's just, never mind kind of, you know, hang-ups with the famine and obsessions of home ownership. It's just a financial reality that in Ireland you need to be a homeowner. And it's much more financially advantageous to be a homeowner. And we think, you know, when most people die, when they leave their estates, if you read the newspapers, you know, they talk about people's wills and what is left in people's wills. The vast majority of that money is in property. So that's what we pass on to our kids, you know.
Okay, there's some messages coming in as well, and this is still following on from the debate between James Lawless and Owen O'Brien earlier on. One listener here says that her daughter is paying €800 a month. It's now going up to €950 per month. She's working full time, but she could be living closer to us in a beautiful mobile home, as we have 1.5 acres, but they can't get planning permission for that mobile home to be put on their land. Also, another listener says, how do people that rent get a mortgage? I tried and I keep getting told, since I am unable to save a deposit due to my high rent, tough luck. I'm not good enough for a mortgage. Plus, I don't have family here that could be helping. That's the other thing, Lorcan. If you're forking out €1,300-1,400 a month in rent, it's going to be very hard to save a deposit.
Absolutely. Well, there's two things there. The first checks are in, Owen. Rent that's going from 800 to 900 a month, it looks to me like it could well be, or 950, whatever you said there, could well be in breach of the amount that should be allowed as a rent increase. And the second check there, it's incredibly difficult for people to save when they're paying huge amounts of money, particularly if they know that their actual mortgage, if they had one, would be less than the amount of money that they're paying in the rent. And so this, back to the point about, you know, fewer and fewer, the smaller proportion of new homes coming to the market. I mean, schemes like the Help to Buy and you know, shared equity and all these kind of schemes, they're of limited value, really, if there aren't the houses there that they can be applied to. So what happens then is, when you're building fewer and fewer houses, or you know, the proportion is becoming less and less of what we're building every year, the prices just go up, you know. So which makes it even harder for people. So I think, you know, we need a whole rethink about what we're doing in the rental sector and how we're treating landlords, how we're treating tenants. And we also need to see a much greater emphasis on homes coming to the market for sale and not expensive rentals. I mean, I don't care whether they're apartments or houses. I don't really, that's neither here nor there. The point is whether they're for rent or for sale, and increasingly they're for rent and they should be for sale.
Okay, finally then, Lorcan, you are an expert when it comes to housing. How bleak does the future look, or is there a glimmer of hope, do you think, down the line?
Let's be clear on, I'm looking at Dáil debates from the 1950s, right? And the same arguments, you know, they didn't have apartment stuff in the 1950s and institutional investors, but pretty much the same arguments are going on since the 1950s. Actually, in 1956, if you look at the biggest issue in housing in 1956 is where they're going to house all the refugees that were coming into the country. And in 1956, the refugees weren't coming from Ukraine, they were coming from Hungary. But the biggest thing that was occupying politicians' minds was where we were going to house all the refugees. The same arguments as, you know, in 2022 and 2023. So it never gets better. I think one of the interesting things that's going to happen this year is that I suspect the market for apartment developments and these rentals is probably dead in the water now. And you begin to see, we're beginning to see a push from house builders to say, look, we don't need to build apartments. We want to build own door housing. In other words, pretty much normal housing that we've traditionally built in Ireland very well. And you know, I suspect we're going to see a push back for that again. And Kildare, it will be one of the main beneficiaries of that. You know, the last 5 years, the new housing in Kildare is up hundreds of percent, and that's where an awful lot of first-time buyers are going. First-time buyer activity is up a huge amount in Kildare, so Kildare is probably one of the counties that will benefit from that because house builders have a lot of land out there, and you know, it's a fairly straightforward place to build.
Okay, on that note, Dr. Lorcan Sir, Senior Lecturer in Housing at the Technological University of Dublin, thanks for your time this morning, Lorcan. Saying figures suggest that Ireland has built more properties for rent than for sale for the first time in generations. And of course, keep those messages coming in to us. There's another one in here from Kay that says, I was wondering, anyone that travels the road from Milltown to Kilmeag, what do they think about the state of the road past the shop in Kilmeag? Kay says it's disgraceful, and all the money taxpayers pay for motor tax to use the roads, etc. Well, I can tell you, Kay, that I'm going to be driving out that road later on this evening, so I will take a look at it for you and see if there's anything can be done. I know there were a couple of listeners that were on to me about Ballantyne Lane. We brought that to the attention of Dara Fitzpatrick, the Fianna Fáil councillor, and also there, just at the church in Allen, the hill down towards Allen Cross roads, that road is quite bad. I think that's being looked at as well. But if you're saying it's just on the main road there from Milltown to Kilmeag, we'll check that out for you later on this evening.
Kildare Today with Owen Beattie.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Okay, just some news breaking this morning. Gary Lineker is going to return to presenting sport for the BBC days after being pulled off air for comments he made about British government policy. The BBC repeated an apology to audiences but stopped short of saying sorry to the Match of the Day presenter. The corporation is also launching a review into its social media guidelines. So Gary Lineker will return to presenting sport for BBC. Okay, we mentioned this at the top of the programme. I was reading an article in the Irish Examiner over the weekend. It was under the headline, Natural Health, Menopausal Itch Wakes Me Up in the Morning. Well, on the line is Christine Lane, clinical governance expert in women's health, a menopause coach and a registered nurse. Good morning, Christine, and good to talk to you again.
A very good morning to you, and thank you for having me on the show.
So I was reading about this, as I say, and this woman who explained some of the symptoms that she has. She's 50 years of age. She's going through menopause. She wakes up in the morning with what she describes as a severe itch, and that can range from her genital areas, scalp, arms, ankles, her back. Walking, she says, is almost impossible. Her eyes are dry, her gums and her mouth feel dry and uncomfortable. It sounds dreadful, Christine. What do you think it is?
It definitely is dreadful, Owen. It's one of two things. It's most likely, if she's 50 years of age, Owen, it's most likely that it is related to the menopause. So what causes this itching in our body is histamine, and we need histamine in the body. It supports our, we make it in our mast cells, and it supports our gut, our brain, our immune, our nervous systems. The trouble arises is if we produce too much of it, we develop what's known as like a histamine intolerance. So itching is a real prime example of histamine intolerance. There's lots of other ones. But real severe itching and dryness of the skin, as she described, are symptoms of histamine intolerance.
Some of those other symptoms and conditions associated with histamine intolerance, I know bladder infections, irritable bowel syndrome, indigestion, etc., etc. But for the purpose of this discussion, we will just stay on maybe the impacts that it has in terms of menopause and that itching.
Yes.
I suppose from a woman's point of view, it might be a little bit confusing at the start as to what's causing it. But if they're going through the menopause, it might make a little bit more sense, Christine.
It might. might do, and what I would say to anybody out there listening today is, if you can relate to this, and you're in your 50s and you have this intolerable itching and this dryness, what I would say to you is, most likely it's something you're eating as well, Owen, you know, or drinking. So say, for example, alcohol has histamine in it. And if you drink alcohol, it even triggers further production of histamine. So that can cause itching. Foods that are fermented, kimchi and kefir and kombucha, all those sort of things can cause itching. So what I would say to anybody out there who has this intolerable itching, before you do anything dramatic, you can do this thing called, you can start eliminating certain foods to see is the source of this itching being caused by foods. And actually, there's a website, if you go on it, it's called histamineintolerance.org.uk, and they actually have a low histamine diet on there that you can follow. It's very safe. You would do it for over maybe 4 to 8 weeks. You'd gradually eliminate certain foods to see if the symptoms went away. And 9 out of 10 times, actually, it's food-related. Mm. Another instance might be just that some women are estrogen dominant in the menopause. And if you're estrogen dominant, it'll cause the body to produce more histamines. And this signals then the ovary to produce more estrogen and then produce more histamine, and it's a vicious cycle, you know. So my advice would be, you know, to look at your diet and see if there's anything contributing towards it. If you're having no joy there, I would say to speak with your GP and look at possibly that estrogen dominance is the cause of it.
Yeah, I was doing a bit of research behind it as well, Christine, and I see that diamine oxidase, or DAO, is one of the main enzymes that breaks down histamine. So I think you can go and get medication that inhibit DAO activity, including painkillers and antidepressants. So it's worth discussing that with your doctor if you are on medication, just to get maybe...
Absolutely, yeah, most definitely. Really great point there, Owen. Certain medications that you're on can actually affect it as well. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and your doctor can also test histamine as well, I believe. DAO levels, mast cell activity through blood tests and all of that.
They can, but it's not wholly reliable. I mean, it's only a snapshot of one day. You know, your levels can change from day to day, so it's not 100% reliable.
Okay, what else, in terms of those other symptoms that I mentioned and maybe other issues that might arise during menopause, the likes of hot flushes, the dryness as well, gums and mouth, also maybe periods becoming irregular, there's lots of different things going on and different things at play during the menopause.
Yes. So, I mean, I always say there's at least 40 symptoms of the menopause, from dry eyes to breast pain, constipation, nausea, palpitations, diarrhea, brain fog, bloating, mood swings, night sweats, memory loss. There's an awful lot of symptoms associated with the menopause. But mostly what causes all these symptoms is the decline in hormones. So you have the decline in estrogen, decline in progesterone, and decline in testosterone. So this is 9 out of 10 times the reason why you're experiencing these symptoms. And really and truly, the only way of relieving these symptoms long-term, or certainly getting good relief for these symptoms, is to replace the hormone zone.
Right, okay. And I know that it depends from woman to woman. Everybody's menopause experience is going to be different. But from speaking to women who have gone through it and doing interviews here on the show, it can be quite a burden, you know. I know it's natural and absolutely, but some women might be listening to this who are going through the menopause and thinking, when is this ever going to end? What advice would you give to those women who are in that situation?
Oh, gosh, I hear you, Owen. And, you know, like you rightly said, some women, they barely know. They're getting a hot flush, maybe, or they're a bit forgetful. That's one end of the spectrum. But then, you know, there's severe mental health implications with the menopause. You know, severe anxiety, severe depression, severe loss of confidence, loss of self-esteem. You know, it's not coincidence that the highest rate of suicide is actually in women aged 45 to 54. So we do need to take this quite seriously, and we do need to, it's not really spoken about, and it's definitely something that out of this conversation around menopause, this needs to be highlighted and looked at closer. I would say to anybody out there today who's really struggling, please tell somebody. That somebody might be your partner, it might be a friend, it might be... Tell somebody in the first instance that you're struggling. Somebody you trust, somebody who's going to support you. And then after that, I would strongly advise you to get professional support. Because if you're really struggling like that, the symptoms tend to get worse before they get better. And they only get better with help and support, either, you know, mind-body medicine, HRT, other types of medication. But you definitely need to speak with a health professional and get support from a health professional that specialises in menopause. And if you go and see somebody and you're not happy with the consultation, or you don't feel it was taken as seriously as you feel it should be, please go and get a second opinion.
Hmm. And finally then, Christine, even having this discussion this morning shows that we've come a long way in terms of how we're supporting women with the menopause. It is being taken a lot more seriously. You know, there might be, but years ago it might have been just brushed off. Well, that woman is quite moody, or she's, you know, going through whatever. But now we're taking it more seriously. Women are feeling more comfortable talking about it, and yes, the support is available.
Absolutely. I mean, there is support available. And now, you know, a lot of workplace organisations are now taking on menopause training in the workplace. I recently did some training down with Chrismy in Cork in the week. So for training for the HR and the line managers and the employees. So organisations and workplaces are really, you know, rising up to their responsibilities in terms of staff well-being and protecting women in the workplace as well. So that's really good to see. We've made a lot of advances, Owen, but there still is a lot more to go.
Okay. On that note, Christine Lane, clinical governance expert in women's health, a menopause coach and registered nurse. Thanks for joining us, Christine. And of course, you can find details of Christine Lane on social media and on her website as well. And we were talking primarily about that menopausal itch that women are describing that wakes them up in the morning. And as Christine said there, it could be to do with histamine. And you can check out www.histamineintolerance.org.uk for more information, including a downloadable food diary as well, because it could be to do with dietary choices. But of course, as always, go to your GP if symptoms don't subside and seek professional advice. But thanks to Christine for joining us. Now, I saw this online yesterday and I thought it was quite interesting, actually, and I'd be interested to hear what you think of it. Terms of endearment should not be used when addressing children in childcare settings. A Bright Horizons, one of the biggest childcare firms in the world, has issued a handbook with guidelines for parents. They advise to stop using words that reinforce gender stereotypes, such as princess. Well, on the line is Elaine Dunn, Chair of the Federation of Early Childcare Providers. Good morning, Elaine, and thanks for coming on with us.
No problem. Thank you for having me on.
I think, look, it's hard to know really what to do in this situation. Obviously, this is the handbook that has been issued, but it's very hard with children. Terms of endearment are kind of normal, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. When I read it and I was called on it by the newspaper as well, and I was like, you know, at the end of the day, whatever a parent wants to call their child, that's okay. It's up to the parent. It has to be parent-driven. It's the same when a child comes into our services in the morning and, you know, you might say, good morning, my little princess. Do you know what I mean? And it's a term for us to say, you know, you're very welcome into the service. It's something that would be used a lot, you know, throughout the set. In my service particularly, we would use different words like that, you know, to empower the child to say how wonderful they are. And the same with the boys. You know, you're always trying to empower the child and nurture them throughout the day.
Yeah, and the one that is mentioned here, as we said, is princess, my little princess, or, you know, if a boy comes in, my little man, little prince, anything like that. But do you think the argument there would be that we're becoming a little bit too protective or a little bit too PC when it comes to children? Because we all would have had those terms of endearments when we were younger.
Did it do us any harm, Owen?
I don't think it did at all,
no. No, not at all, and nor me. And I have four wonderful granddaughters, and it's how I address them all the time when I see them. They're, you know, they're only small, and you're just empowering them. You're just how wonderful they are, and it's lovely to see them, and you're happy to welcome them in to your home. You know, I just don't know where this is coming from or where it's going to end, to be quite honest, if that's gone into a parental handbook and coming into a service. That's quite worrying for me as a personally. In my service, that would not be in my handbook.
And I know it probably is coming from the angle of gender stereotypes and, you know, the rise, as we've seen, in people who are feeling more empowered to come out as transgender and that. So it's about, you know, maybe if a little boy or a little girl doesn't feel comfortable in their body, that we're reinforcing those gender stereotypes. But I think that would depend, would it not, Elaine, on the individual themselves. And maybe that's a discussion to be had then with the child's parents.
Absolutely. That's down to parental choice and parental guidance for us. Like, if there was something like that going on, then the parents will come and have a discussion with us. And then that's a private discussion between the provider and the parent. And then how we handle that then is individually within the service.
Yeah, I see some of the messages.
But I have to say, I've never come across it.
No, there's some messages coming in here. May says they are terms of endearment. It's madness. It needs to stop. They, you know, they are normal terms of endearment. Also, Pauline says it's completely normal. I have a granddaughter, 3 years of age. I call her my little princess, and I do so with endearment and with love. And Paul as well says that he remembers when he was younger, he was called a little man. You know, my little man, he said, by his grandfather, and it didn't do him any harm either. It is an interesting conversation. When I saw it, my ears kind of pricked up a little bit when I heard about it, Elaine. But it does kind of raise the question, where do we go from here?
Well, this is exactly it. It's what does the future hold now if we're now being told that we can't use those lovely words of endearment for a child? So where is it going to end up? I mean, in our services, you have from 6 months up to 12 or 13. Do you know what I mean? So where does it end? Or where do we stop? You have to nurture a child throughout the day when they're with you. You have to love and hug them, and you know, all of that is involved. And all of those kind words are involved in nurturing a child. So where does it end? So we're going to stop using any of those words.
All right. I'd be interested to get people's views on it. 0833 97 97 97. That's Elaine Dunn, Chair of the Federation of Early Childcare Providers. Do we need to stop using gender-specific terms of endearment when speaking to children? Or do you feel as though the world has just gone a little bit too protective? Let us know. David Brown says it's all a load of, absolutely, says David. We'll leave it at that. Another one in here says, you mentioned something about the Kilmeague to Allen Milltown Road. It's a pure joke, says this listener. The top layer of tar is gone off parts of the road, and it's a little more than a dirt track this morning. The holes are full of water. Motorists trying to avoid holes. Is this what we're paying the expensive road tax for on our vehicles? And more messages coming in relation to it. As I said, I'm going to be out in that area tonight, so I'll have a look at it this evening. And finally then, if this keeps going, we'll be afraid to say hello to a child. We need to stop all this nonsense and get on with real life, according to another listener.
Kildare Today with Owen Beatty.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Sports Review Monday on Kildare Today.
Yes, indeed, and you may have already heard this, but starting off with some sad news. Offaly GAA say that they are devastated after the sudden death of their senior football manager, Liam Kearns. The Kerry native passed away last night. Kearns took over Offaly last year, having previously managed Limerick, Laois and Tipperary. As a player, Kearns won an All-Ireland minor medal with Kerry in 1980. So the current Offaly senior football manager, Liam Kearns, has passed away at the age of 61. Here in the county, though, the Kildare Hurlers stretched their unbeaten run in all competitions to 15 on Saturday. They beat Kerry in Division 2A by 220 to 21 points in St Connolly's Park to chalk up 4 league wins out of 4, and the win guarantees David Herity's squad at least a Division 2A home semi-final. Ger McNally is on the line now. Himself and Seamus Dillon did full commentary of that match on Saturday in association with Hanlon Concrete Products of Robertstown. And Ger, the hurling train keeps going.
Yeah, absolutely, Owen. And a fantastic performance and a fantastic result. With all due respect to the three teams that Kildare had beaten previously in this year's league, coming in on Saturday against Kerry, everybody kind of realised that it was a step up in standard against a very experienced side and a side with a great know-how of playing in the upper echelons of this division and competing for McDonagh Cups over the last couple of years. So as well as Kildare had played in their opening three rounds, that they really knew that they were going to have to produce something across the full 70 minutes to get a result on Saturday. And I have to say, I think it's one of the best performances that I've seen from a Kildare hurling team in a long, long time. Right from the very off, they really did set down a marker against Kerry, and they were superb, really. Not everything kind of came off that they tried, but you couldn't fault their work rate, their attitude, their effort, their determination. And any time that they did give possession away, they worked so, so hard to win it back. And in the end, it was a thoroughly deserved result that puts them a couple of wins now away from Division 1 hurling, which is just incredible.
Yeah, let's hear now from manager David Herity speaking after that game.
I am delighted, yeah. I suppose throughout the last kind of week or two, a lot of people would have said, yeah, we won three, but I suppose the step up was coming, and I suppose that we might wilt. But I'm delighted to see how we performed there today. And kind of, again, even last year, I know when we played Kerry, we were doing very well up until the 70th minute, and unfortunately let it slip then those last few minutes, and they won by 8. So look, again, a lot of things went our way there today. We got the two goals at the right time, which just kept us nicely ahead there, and kept that kind of 8 points in it for long periods in the second half.
I know it's hard, Ger, to pinpoint, you know, individual players, but if you were to look at some of the individual performances, who stood out at the weekend?
Yeah, right across the team, I have to say, first of all, it was a really hard-working display, so it probably is unfair to pick out individuals, but amongst a really well-rounded team performance, there's always going to be individuals that stand out. And I have to say, I started with the back line, really, because I thought Milan Munikon was absolutely brilliant at cornerback, and his experience is absolutely crucial. Moving forward, Ryan Bourne as well, very, very good. James Burke in the half-forward line scored 12 points from 12 shots before missing with his last effort of the game that dropped just a little bit short. And again, he was superb. Jerry Keegan looks like he's really back to his old self now again. He scored an absolutely outstanding second goal at a crucial time in the game because Kerry had, I think, scored 3 points in a row to cut the Kildare lead back from 8-5, and it just looked as if they were starting to build a little bit of momentum, perhaps with maybe half an eye on that game last year in Kerry that David Herity mentioned there when Kerry made a late comeback to steal the win off Kildare. But Keegan's goal was as well taken as it was well timed, and really good to see him back in the side. But as I said, from 1 to 15 and the lads that came in, it was just an excellent all-round performance.
Yeah, so it's 15 games unbeaten now in all competitions for the Kildare Hurlers. The toughest test yet, though, Ger, will be this coming weekend against Offaly, who are also unbeaten and have 4 wins from 4 in Division 2A. So really it's a crucial crunch game in Tullamore.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And what a prize and offer if Kildare can get a victory over Offaly. But at the same time, I suppose Kildare will have bigger games to come because Saturday's win means that they are guaranteed at the very least a league semi-final. Of course, the win on Sunday against Offaly would negate the need to play that semi-final. They'd go straight into a league final. But at the same time, they now have that safety net of knowing that they will have a semi-final at least, and that semi-final will be at home. And I think it's pretty much confirmed now that it'll be against Kerry again in Newbridge, should Kildare fail to win next week. But yeah, look, Kildare will go to Tullamore with confidence absolutely sky high. People involved in hurling right around the country are sitting up and taking note of the Kildare hurlers. I saw somebody on social media comparing them to the Derry footballers for the way that they've come from the lower ranks of the of course, it's been a long time coming, but the last couple of years things have really accelerated for Kildare, and they've moved up to the divisions, and to be on the brink now of Division 1 hurling, it just says what a good job David Herity, his backroom team and all the players have done. And yeah, what a game it is on Sunday. And again, I'd say to the Kildare people, you know, they it was actually a pretty decent crowd considering the weather was quite poor on Saturday afternoon. And they give credit to the Hurling County Board. They had a lot of posters there for young kids who were involved at halftime, and it was heartening to see the Kildare players still on the pitch half an hour after the final whistle signing autographs for those young kids. So there's definitely a momentum and a buzz behind the Kildare Hurlers at the moment. And yeah, it's just a pity that Sunday, I think it's near impossible to make it from Tullamore to the Gaelic Grounds and Limerick for the footballing game later on in the afternoon. It's a pity that supporters can't attend both games if they so wished. But yeah, and everybody involved in the hurling really should be getting down to Tullamore to support these lads, because they are doing that, the county very proud indeed.
Well, if anybody can make it from the Gaelic grounds to Tullamore or vice versa, it's you, Ger, but we'll leave it at that. That is Ger McNally.
We needed to invest in a KFM helicopter.
Helicopter, yeah. That's Ger McNally, KFM sports commentator. Of course, we'll have much more reaction to the hurling game this evening on Kildare Scoreboard. We'll have analysis, interviews and post-match reaction as well. The man choking beside me here is Seamus Dillon, who was also on commentary duty with Ger McNally at that game on Saturday. But before that, Seamus, was the Kildare Camogie side who had their second game of the league campaign. They won the first one against Tyrone, unfortunately beaten by Armagh in Connaught's Park on Saturday.
Yeah, thanks, Owen. Good morning. Both teams came into that round two encounter, Armagh having beaten Mayo very easily, and Kildare accounting for Tyrone, hitting 7.21, I think, that particular afternoon, or 7.12 it actually was. But on this occasion, it was Armagh who were the strongest. Kildare trailed 8-3 at the half-time break. Armagh were a stronger, more physical team than Kildare, and conditions were horrendous. In fairness to both sets of girls, it poured rain throughout, blowing nearly like a frost in the breeze. So it was hard for them to come to terms with the conditions. But in fairness to Armagh, they were the better team. 8-3 at the half-time break. And then Armagh kicked on in the second half with two goals. Shauna Quinn from the middle of the field, and then corner forward Rachel Murray, who was their top scorer with 1-4. Stronger and more physical team. But Joe Quaid probably would have been happy enough with Kildare's performance. They're building. They've a weak enough panel in the sense that they've 20 in the numbers, and they did line out without Hannah Davis, who'd be the one of their mainstays. The Maynooth midfielder did come in early stages of the second half, but probably most of the damage had been done at that stage. But Kildare move on now next weekend with a game against Mayo, and Tyrone will be the Armagh's next opponents.
Absolutely. Let's hear from the Kildare manager then, Joe Quaid.
The strange part about it was, I think we were only down, probably down at half time, 5 at half time. And I actually think, even though we lost the second half by more, it was a far better performance. Look, Armagh are around a long time, they're a seasoned team. I only found out after Ginny O'Leary, ex-Cork player, is actually playing with them. We were wondering why we couldn't catch up. But the performance the girls gave in the second half, we were actually absolutely delighted with. A lot of young players, they got hits today they've never got.